Today is Tuesday, March 22nd, 1994. My name is Rick Bradley, and I'm in Scottsdale, Arizona, with Eugene Jr. Thompson. Tell me where you got that nickname.
Well, that's real easy. My right name is Junior Eugene. Junior is my given name. I've seen it so many times that they most people just thought I wasn't Junior as a first name and thought I was a junior as from my father or something, but that wasn't true. I think my mother and father, if I remember hearing the story right, they got in an argument about what they were gonna name me, and they just wound up naming me Junior, and that's it. And I've packed that now for almost 77 years. So that's the story there.
What do you remember about being as a small kid about first wanting to play baseball or being interested in baseball?
I think my career, Rick, is a little different than a lot of them. I happened to be going. I was raised pretty much in Decatur, Illinois. And even though it was a pretty good-sized city, we did not have any baseball, no baseball program, whatever. The only programs that we had there was Legion clubs, and I was kind of a big, skinny kid that was wilder and all get out. And as a result of that, I didn't get very much playing time with the Legion program. Then a year or so later, when I was about 16, I guess, 17, I got to where I was able to play with the semi-pro clubs there. A lot of guys a lot older than me, and that was about the only experience I ever had at all before I went out into pro ball. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of an unusual situation because I didn't have high school ball and never. I didn't go to college. I graduated. I didn't graduate. I signed my first contract in 1934 in Decatur, Illinois. There, Charlie Dressen actually signed me. October 1st, 1934, so come October 1st this year, it will be my 60th year. And signed a contract in the fall of that year and then went to the old Penn State Association in Pennsylvania the following year for my first year in pro ball. So I had very little experience, like a lot of kids have in high school. We just didn't have any place to play. We didn't have any team.
What did your family think about you picking baseball as a career?
Well, they were thrilled to death. My father played some professional baseball many years back in the Ohio State League, and always been baseball family, and they were thrilled to death that I did go out. And it wasn't as easy as it might have sounded because there was a lot of ups and downs. I had first year out, I was sent back home. I played for Milton Stock, and I read articles where I got homesick and all this stuff, but in those days, they got away with everything. You know, they put me on the voluntary retired list, even though I didn't know what the world I was getting into when I signed the voluntary retired list. I didn't want to go home, but they put me on there because I wasn't quite ready to play yet. This was in '35, and next year I went out. I went to the old Kitty League ball club down in Paducah, Kentucky. I had quite a year down there. Then from there on in, I started elevating a little bit each year, but it was a I wasn't really that long. I didn't spend near as much time as a lot of people did in those years. I was only in the minor league 4 years, or a lot of them that many years ago. They were 7, 8, 9, 10 years before they ever came to the big leagues. So I was real fortunate.
Were you always a pitcher?
Yes.
Didn't play any other positions?
Well, when I tried to play around the sandlots and stuff like that, I played any place anybody would let me play. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't. I always thought I'd like to be a catcher. But I don't suppose that would have worked out very well.
Well, why was that? Why would you like to?
I don't know. I just had in my mind I would like to. I couldn't even answer you why. I might tell you this story before we go any further because I think it's a good story to show you how fortunate I have been. I went to spring training in 1939 as a non-roster player. And in those years, when you went to spring training like I did, you're just going to throw a whole bunch of batting practice. That's the only reason you're there. Not that you're going to be used for those purposes. And even though I'd had a pretty decent year the year before, that still didn't mean a whole lot because I come out of a B league. In those years, we had the A, B, C, and D, A, B, and so forth. But anyway, when I got to Florida, about just the time that they started playing exhibition games, several of our pitchers who were guys that are going to be everyday pitchers for the ball club in that year, they came down with the flu and met three of them, Vandermeer and Derringer and Walters. And as a result of this, people like me got a chance to pitch. Had they not gotten sick, I would never had a chance to pitch, and I probably would have never been to the big leagues. So I'm telling this story because I'm so very thankful that I had an opportunity, which I might not have ever gotten again. But and the exciting part about it was, and the first game that I was in with another pitcher who he'd been there the year before a little bit, that boy named Whitey Moore, he's dead now. He and I pitched a no-hitter against the Brooklyn ball club. And that kind of raised our eyes a little bit, but that still didn't mean that we hadn't made. We still got a lot more pitching. And then the next game I was in was the game I was telling you about when I pitched against the Red Sox. And I was quite awed by those people because, as I mentioned to you, there was 5 Hall of Fame players in the lineup that day that I pitched against. So these are things that, these are many, many things like that that stuck out in my mind. And as I say again, I was very fortunate and very thankful.
You talked a little bit about your minor league career, but there's one game in particular I wanted to ask you about. When you were with Peoria in 37, mm-hmm. You pitched a game, the first guy singled, and the next 27 went down in a row.
Yeah. I remember that very well. The only other time I pitched a one-hitter, I believe, if I remember right, it was against Brooklyn in the big leagues. And Lou Riggs, who had been with us the year before, clubbed one off the end of his bat for a base hit in the Brooklyn ballpark. That was the only other time I think I pitched a one-hitter. But I remember very well. I remember a lot of those, but I remember a lot when I got wrapped pretty good, too.
Okay. 1939, you said that you got the chance because of the flu bug going around.
Right.
Now you have the team made. You make the team out of spring training. And was it different then in 1939? Here you are, a young guy. How were you treated by your fellow teammates?
Outstanding. Outstanding. Everybody in the world was very helpful and tried to do everything they could. I've heard so many stories about the old-timers used to be upset when the young guys came in, but I never found this to be the case, and we're talking about, nearly 50-some years ago, 55 or more years ago. I didn't find it that way. They were all very helpful to me. I think the other thing that I've told this story so many times, I think the difference a lot was in managing, because Bill McKechnie, who has gone down and will be remembered as being one of the greatest managers in our game. As a matter of fact, I don't know of anybody that ever won 3 pennants in the same league with 3 different ball clubs other than him. This has been a trivial question over the years. He handled us so well, and I had never been handled in this manner. We started out in spring training much different than a lot of them do now. We started out by spinning balls. We went around the rubber the first day, which is unheard of. You go to camp and you warm up on the sideline. He said, hey, as long as you're going to warm up on the sideline, you might as well be on the rubber. They don't want anybody to throw hard. And every once in a while, spin the ball like you're going through the motion of trying to throw break and stuff. And you got a live hitter up there. And it's good for him and it's good for you. But I think the end result of this and what we enjoyed most, we didn't have any sore arms. I read the paper every day where this guy's got a full muscle in his shoulder and that guy's got something wrong with him and this guy's got something. I don't remember us going through all this stuff, but I think it was due to the way we were trained and what I'm talking about. Because his theory was that by doing this, you went through both sorenesses at the same time. When we talk about both sorenesses, we're talking about a fastball soreness and talking about a curveball soreness because you get different reactions from both of them. But for those people that will just throw fastballs, where they're throwing pretty hard, now they think they're ready, and they think they're ready to throw the breaking pitch. This is when they can become hurt and pulls and everything else in there. So I think this is one of the things that helped me, too, a great deal, and helped me. I had a lot better control, and it just seemed like, he was a saver for me. And the guy that you mentioned, the game in Peoria, the guy that I played for there was outstanding for me. I played for him 2 years. He's a full-blooded Cherokee Indian by the name of Ben Tincup, and he was a great pitching instructor. And he had a lot of patience, and he needed a lot of patience with me because I was probably the wildest guy in the world. But he kept with me, stayed right with me. Nowadays they don't want to fool them. They want to keep pushing them back when you're wild. But if you've got ability, well, one way to get it out of it, and that's to just put you out there and let you pitch. you get beat, you get beat, but you finally come to. Just a good example of that would have been now would have been a guy like Koufax, if they'd have given up on Koufax. Yeah. Lord, nobody was any wilder than him, unless it was me. So it just shows you what can be accomplished by having some friends, have some know-how, and have some patience.
39 season. So you're 22 years old?
I wasn't 22. I was born 17.
17.
So I didn't become 22 until the middle of the season in 39.
So you're 21, you turn 22, and you're in the big leagues, and you had a pretty good year. 13-5, ERA is 2.5, and Cincinnati goes to the World Series. And tell me about the four-game series.
That's kind of embarrassing to tell you about that. I was hit pretty hard. I think they were just better than we were. I could just drive the whole thing. It was kind of like men playing with the boys. And you and I spoke about this club, these clubs that they had in those days a little bit a while ago. Our ball club was mainly, it was defense. We had great infielders and great outfielders. And, of course, regardless of what anybody says, those are the people that make your pitchers. If you don't have those guys, you don't have pitching. Because you've got to have the double play made, and you got to have the guys thrown out here and there, and so on and so forth. So, we escaped. In fact, I recall that 39, we won 43 games by one run, and everybody said, "Well, this is great pitching," but again, it's great defense too. So we just didn't have the offensive power that they had. They had Dickey and Selkirk and Keller and DiMaggio and. You know, so on and so forth. These people just on and on and on. I mean, with power to burn. They were rather awesome getting out on the mound 60 feet away and looking at them, I'll tell you that, for me as a kid.
Well, neither team hit real well in the series. The Yankees only hit 206 and Reds only hit 203.
Well,
in the game that you pitched,
the
Yankees only had five hits.
Yeah, but four of them were out of the park. The mad hit, too. I can remember. I can see them leaving the park. Keller won and Selkirk won. They were pretty good.
Following year, another good year for you. 16-9, ERA is a little bit higher, 3.32. This is something that doesn't happen anymore. 31 games started, 17 complete games, which is, teams don't have 17 complete games now. And Cincinnati was in first place again by a big margin, and you go back again to the World Series.
Again, defense. The combination of pitching and your glove, people, but. This was, Bill McKechnie was that type of a manager, was very conservative. He would bunt for one run a lot of times when other clubs wouldn't. And he'd come back on the bench and they'd be hollering at him about bunting. And he said, "I'll get the last laugh because when I get one run ahead of them, they got to have two. And with this group I got, it's going to be tough for them to get two runs." And this is just his philosophy. And we won 43 games the first year by one run. I don't remember what we won in 40. In 40, but you're talking about those complete games. I had an article sent me from it was during the 50 series, or 90 series, in the 50th anniversary of our 40 series. Mm-hmm. There was quite an article in the Cincinnati Enquirer, and I kind of put it aside here. In about a month or so ago, I was just picked up some of the stuff and looking at it, and he had written an article in there reference to complete games. Those four of us that started. Most of the games, four of us. In those years, as you know, we didn't have five starters. We pitched 81 complete games.
Over half the season. Okay. That's amazing. I'll tell you what, let's go to a couple things that happened in 1940, and then we'll talk about the World Series. But there was early in the year, there was a flood at Crosley Field.
Yes, sir. We were in Chicago. And we knew that the ballpark had lively not much water. As a matter of fact, they rode a boat over the center field wall. And when we finished the series in Chicago and came home, we played, but we couldn't get in our dugout. But the field was playable. That we had a groundskeeper that was just unreal, Matty Schwab, and his boy was working to help him at the time. They had that field ready to play when we got back. It was from a series in Chicago. And it had been completely flooded. You know what happened over there? The sewers all drained backed up during any of the high waters and high, hard rains. Everything seemed to just settle right in that ballpark. As a matter of fact, there was a there was an old saying made one time, reference to what we're talking about. They said that Ernie Lombardi did everything for the Cincinnati Ball Club but keep the river out of park. And he did that.
Now the other thing I want to talk about from the 40 season was what we talked about when we first sat down was Willard Hershberger.
Yes. Very sad. Very, very, very sad. As I had mentioned to you, Hershey was a very bad hypochondriac, and I still feel bad to this day, and I know a lot of my buddies did too. We thought we were having a lot of fun with him. We'd make a lot of fun with him from taking pills and taking this and atomizers. We'd buy atomizers and stick it up in his locker and everything in the world. And we didn't realize that we were just leading him closer, I guess, to what eventually happened in his suicide. But I think the whole thing was, as I mentioned to you earlier, Hershey didn't catch a whole lot, because when that big Italian was ready to catch, he caught. So Hershey would pick up the second games of the doubleheader, and then that was fine. He was satisfied with that. I don't think he ever wanted to be the number one guy. But I think then when he realized after those injuries, and Lombardi had gotten hurt in the Brooklyn game, and then we went from there to the Polo Grounds, and Hershey had to catch. That was it. We had a third catcher, but he wasn't very much of a catcher to put in the ball game and leave every game. And Hershey apparently called for a bad pitch that night, according to Bill McKechnie, and he got on him about it. And then after that series ended, we go to Boston for four doubleheaders in a row. Now, he's going to have to catch all those. And I think it was just too much for him. And he'd had a meeting with Bill McKechnie the night before. We didn't know this until sometime later. He had a meeting with him and discussed his problems and so forth. And he said he told him that night that he was going to commit suicide. And he said when he left him at 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the morning that he thought he was in pretty good humor, and so he never thought too much more about it. But he took his life the next morning after his roomie left the ballpark to go to the ball game in Boston. It was very sad, and he's a great player. Real good hitter. And for the job that he was doing with us, he was perfectly satisfied to do that, and he was great for that job. God rest his soul.
The 40 series, you guys won.
Yes.
But you didn't have once again, very much luck.
No. Hank Greenberg took care of that. He hit a ball out of the Brick Stadium that I think tore out about six or eight seats up in the upper deck. The first time he came up, I struck him out on a sidearm curveball. And the next time up, I got two strikes on him, and I'm going to try to do the same thing, and I just made a little mistake with it and got it inside. Well, Greenberg was pretty strong, and he hit it pretty strong, too. That was a real oddball series because it was a hard-played series, and needless to say, because it went seven games. But we were very fortunate in that series because you wouldn't have seen the old Cincinnati ballpark. There was a terrace all the way around from left field all the way to right field. And the terrace would run from the fence in and at an angle, probably a 15, 20 degree angle. And it was extended toward the playing field probably 20, 25 feet. Well, for a lot of people that hadn't played in there and didn't realize about the way that thing angled up, if they were backtracking, then they could fall down. Well, to start the seventh inning off, which was the inning that we went ahead by one run and later won it by the one run, Greenberg was backtracking on a routine fly ball that Frank McCormick hit. And he fell, and the ball fell in for a double. As a result of that, and before the inning was over, we scored a run. And of course, the biggest story of that game was, even beside our winning it, was that Bobo Newsom that was his third start in the series. And that day, on the seventh day, which we beat him, was the day his father passed away. And he pitched one heck of a game. We should have been playing yet, for that matter. Because I don't think we got a run of it. Greenberg had to fall down and drop the fly ball. It was very interesting.
How well did you know Bobo?
Well, not well, other than just playing against him, you know. We didn't see too much of them in the spring training. It seemed to me like we played the Yankees and Boston Red Sox. Every time I looked up, we were either playing the Yankees or Boston in the spring training. So we didn't see too much of Detroit Club in those years, as I remember.
So 2 years in the big leagues, you're 29 and 14. And what are you thinking at this point? This is easy, or?
No, I never thought it was easy. No, hell no. No.
But a young guy, 23
never was
years old,
easy. You had to grind them all out, I'll tell you.
Anyway, 41, you didn't have as much luck.
Well, I got to tell you a story in between here. Before the 40 season was over, I was talking to my wife about it just the other day, we were playing in St. Louis, and I pitched a two-hit shutout against the Cardinals. Probably as good a game as I ever pitched. Never felt better in my life. And I mean, this is weird, what I'm going to tell you. This was on a Sunday afternoon. Well, my home was in Decatur, Illinois, about halfway between St. Louis and Cincinnati. And my wife had driven down the game. And Bill McKechnie saw her in the stands. And he said, after I pitched the game, he said, "Hey, I see Dorothy's here, my wife." And he said, "Hey, we got Monday off. We're not going to play till Tuesday night. Why don't you go ahead and go home with her, and then you can drive her back to Cincinnati on Tuesday morning and be there in time for the game Tuesday evening."
Yeah, nice of
him. Tuesday night. I said, "Hey, fine. What, you didn't wonder how many times to give you a chance to do this." So Bill was good to me. I said, "Fine." Got in the car and went home. And next morning I woke up, I couldn't raise my arm up. Couldn't even get it up this high. And I'm up just barely up from my side. Oh, my God, what in the world? And I couldn't wait to get to Cincinnati to get a uniform on and get a ball in my hand. Now, what way I hurt myself, I'll never know. If I had felt something strained during the game. But this was when my trouble started. And this was caused me a lot of trouble in that World Series because I didn't have near the stuff that I ordinarily would have had. But I don't know yet. And then from that time forward, I was taking a lot of medicine and a lot of shots, and we were getting a lot of therapy at the time, with x-ray therapy, and everybody used everything in the world. And I had trouble with it from then on until I finally quit pitching. And don't know, as I say to this day, whatever caused it.
Well, we talked a little bit about 41 and 42. Now, the Reds, World Series 39, World Series 1940, and 41, they finished 12 games out, and in 42, they were 29 games back. What happened to the team? Why did they drop out so fast?
I don't believe I could put my finger on it. As a matter of fact, I can't recall now the changes that we had made in those years. I think, I'm not sure if Werber was still with us. I don't believe he was still with us. Werber was a catalyst on our ball club. Great money player. I think Billy Myers was gone, the shortstop. Derringer, of course, was getting a little old. Derringer had been around quite a while. And I might say this, that Derringer and Walters were two of the greatest pitchers I ever saw. To be on a club with him, it was an absolute joy. They're the ones that named the game, boy. Those two guys won 52 games for us in 39. They're unreal. Unreal. I don't think you can ever put your finger on something like that, but we just didn't have the ball club. We just didn't have the pitching. Our pitching wasn't deep enough. Of course, I didn't start at all after 40. Well, very little in 41. Very little. That would be a good question to try to answer, but I couldn't answer why we dropped that much.
Something happened in spring training in 42 that I was reading about that seemed pretty funny to me. Happened to Lonnie Fry. There was a spring training game, and they were trying to get the national anthem going, and they couldn't, I don't know if it was a recording or a record or whatever, and they couldn't, it was broke or something like that, so they started the game, and he was out at second base, and they hit a ground ball to him, and all of a sudden the national anthem popped on, and he stood up and took his cap off, and the ball rolled right by him. Do you remember that?
I don't remember that.
Do you remember that?
No, I sure don't. No, I know. I'm sure it probably happened.
His nickname was Error of the Day, I guess.
Error of the Day, I guess it would be. Error of the Day.
Anyway, 43, the book here says that you were voluntarily retired.
That covers a multitude. I took such a cut in 1943 that it was unreal. And I was on the verge of going into service anyway. And I thought, I won't go back. Giles, this is not very nice thing to talk about. Maybe I should even talk about it, but a lot of us didn't get along with Mr. Giles too well. And I really think what the story was, he had signed me after my second year. He signed me to a 2-year contract. Now, this I know this is the way the general manager feels. Here, I got a young guy here, and if I gave him this 2-year contract, I've done a heck of a job, you know. Well, then it turned out that I wasn't quite the pitcher that he thought I was going to be, so I think he was upset with me a great deal. And he cut me, I mean, it wasn't a cut, it was an operation. and I didn't go back. Because as I say, I thought I was going to be in a service earlier. I didn't go into service until July. But I was, according to the way the numbers were, at the time I was supposed to have gone in about 1st of April. And there's no point in me going over there and going through spring training and doing all this stuff. And I'll just lay it out, which I did. So then I came back out of the Navy in 45, and then time to go to spring training in 46. And I was having a lot of knee problems at the time, too. And I had a lot of knee problems before I left Cincinnati. I wound up wearing a brace over there before I left there. This may have had something to do with a little bit of arm trouble, too, but I still think something else had happened. I can't put my finger on it. But that was the reason for the Sharks, for not being out in 43 and 44 and 45. I was in the Navy 27 months.
Where were you stationed?
I went to Great Lakes in the beginning, and then I transferred from there to New London, submarine base New London, Connecticut. And I finished up, well, I didn't finish up there. I finished up in the hospital with leg operation, knee operation, in Newport, Rhode Island. And I was mustered out of the Navy and out of the hospital in Newport, Rhode Island.
Did you play any ball when you were in the service?
Some. But I kept having trouble with my knee all the time, and that's the reason why they finally put me in the hospital. We tried to play some. In fact, that's when Yogi and I were together. We were together for several 2 years over there. He's about a guy.
46 season. You start off with the Reds again in spring training, mm-hmm.
and then about a month
in the season.
They released me out, right. And I had several chances with several different ball clubs to sign on with them. And I kind of wanted to stay in the National League. I had a chance to go to the Yankees at the time. And I went over. The Giants called me and wanted me to come work out with them. And I went and spent a road trip with them. And they wanted to see if I was sound because I'd had all this problem anyway, especially with my knee. And I was able to throw decent. I can tell you that I knew myself that I wasn't a starting pitcher anymore. I couldn't go that long without breaking down. But I could pitch 2 or 3 or 4 innings and felt pretty good. And so that from then on, I relieved all the time every place I went. And I relieved at New York, relieved at New York in 46 and part of 47. And I left 47, latter part of the season, and went to Jersey City. And then went back to spring training with the Giants down here in spring training here in South Phoenix, 1948, as a non-roster player. And then I didn't hang out, didn't stay on the ball. I made the spring training trip with them, didn't stay with them during the trip back. Then I joined San Diego and pitched San Diego for 2 years. 1 year under Rip Collins, one year under Bucky Harris, and I was sold to Sacramento. I was 2 years up there, one as a player, coach, and one as just a coach altogether. I coached 1 year for Joe Morgan and 1 year for Joe Gordon. Then went to South America, managed the club. I'm back and went to work for New York scouting 43 years ago. Mm-hmm. Here we are.
We're right here. When you were through playing ball, I mean, it was your decision or their decision, or you just had enough, or?
I'll tell you what. if you've never played this game, the hitters, if you're a pitcher, the hitters will let you know when you better be finding something else to do. It's very obvious. Well, you can't get them out anymore, and you get embarrassed when you don't get them out. You know, when you have gone through those times when you were a decent pitcher, and then have to go through that, well, it ain't worth it. So I just you know when you're done, it's not hard. I never looked back. I never regretted it, because I played 17 years. You know, that's enough. Anyway,
we'll just digress here for a little bit. Describe your pitching motion for me, if you would, and then tell me the what your pitch is.
My pitching motion?
Yeah.
I couldn't even describe it for you. I'll tell you what. This is funny. Somebody asked me, they ask you this often, were you a fastball pitcher or were you a curveball pitcher? And the other night, my wife was going through some old scrapbooks. I don't know why in the world I have noticed some of this stuff. It's all been put in there. And somebody said, were you a curveball or a fastball? And I said, I don't really know. How hard you? I said, I don't know how hard I threw. We didn't have any measurements, you know, like we have now. Mm-hmm. I have a jug gun I carry with me all the time, but nobody knew that. But I was running through some of those articles, and there was a little bit of a piece of paper, about a little clipping about an inch or an inch and a half high, and it was a quote by Jimmy Fox, one of the days I pitched against him down there. And he mentioned that I threw him two curveballs. It was the greatest curveballs he'd ever seen. So maybe I was a curveball pitcher. I don't know. And I don't know how hard it was. So I guess I must have had fairly good stuff, but I don't know this. You know, I don't think you have any way of knowing your own ability or your own limitations. I don't believe I understand this. And I couldn't even answer your question. Couldn't do it.
You hit okay in the...
I wasn't too bad a hitter. Yeah. I wasn't too bad a hitter.
Did you like to hit?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I reckon. I got to tell you this. I hit 1,000 in the World Series. I didn't do very good pitching, but I hit 1,000.
One for one.
I got to tell that story.
Well, tell me about that hit you hit.
I hit it off of Hildebrand. Gomez and I, as you're looking at that picture right over your shoulder, that was taken just before that first game of the series, that 39 series against Lefty and I. And he might have been gone just a little bit ahead of me. I don't think he lasted much, but maybe he didn't last quite as long as I did, which wasn't very long. And I think I hit it off of Hildebrand. Hit a ball up the middle, center field. But, you know, there was a lot of pitchers in those years. That we had Derringer and Walters both on our club, were good hitters. And you had good power. Walters was a converted third baseman, from a third baseman, and he was a good hitter. Ball hit good. I never could hit the ball very far, but I could get the bat on the ball pretty good. But I think this come from, you know, now when you were a kid, you hit all the time, because you didn't have a designated hitter in the minor days. When I first started, we only had 15 man rosters, and we were playing the same number of games they're playing now, 120 and 140 game schedules with 15 men. That meant we had five pitchers, and when you start that game, there wasn't many replacements out there for you. You had to use out there, and it was all over with. So you learned to hit, and you learned to get them out, so you didn't die out there, you know. So that was there was a lot of pitchers that hit the ball pretty good in those days. A bunch of them.
Let me just throw three or four names at you, some guys that hit against you, and then you tell me if they wore you out.
Tell you the best hitter I ever pitched against. And one hell of a complete player. Archie Vaughn at Pittsburgh, the Hall of Famer. I've made this remark and kind of in jest, but it's true. I've always said that he could hit me at midnight with the lights out. He could hit me like he's pitching to himself. There was a few I could get out pretty good. Harry Danning, I remember. Harry used to hate to see me even getting a uniform. Catcher with the Giants. And what I did different than him, I don't know. It was just the fact that I think a lot of times it becomes mental that you can't hit or you can get a guy out. And I got to tell this story about Archie Vaughn. After I went to Coast League, I hadn't seen Archie Vaughn in a long time. Long time. Well, I had joined San Diego, and he had joined the Oakland club. And Casey was managing the club at Oakland when Archie was there. Now, the first time they came into our place down in San Diego, they brought me in out of the bullpen to relieve somebody. And the bases loaded, and who do you think the hitter was? Arky Vaughn. And I'm standing on the mound, and I'm saying, I hope to hell he don't recognize me. This is true. That's just what's going through my mind. And the first ball I turned loose, he hit a line drive at the second. Bobby Wilson, little guy, played with the Cleveland organization for a long time, second base. And he liked to kill him, but he held on to it and doubled the guy off a second. So that's where I got him out. I had hoped he wouldn't remember me, but he did. He sure did.
Even his outs hurt, huh?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Hey, what?
Go ahead.
No, I had to tell that story because he hit me. It was unreal, just unbelievable. I had a lot of trouble with a lot of hitters, but not near like him. I didn't have that much trouble with Mize. I always pitch Mize inside. And when Musial first came up, I had pretty good luck with Musial. I think one of the reasons for it, I was probably a little bit unorthodox in one sense, and this is something that we try to teach. But I've done a lot of teaching, instructing since I've been, you know, scouting and helping with our minor league ball clubs and helping with the major league club for several years. I think one of the things that we lose sight of more than anything in the world, I think the most underrated thing in pitching is deception. And I say this because about 90% of all your pitchers have pretty much the same kind of stuff, pretty much the same velocity, pretty much the same kind of curveball and this and that. But some of them are a lot more successful than others with the same stuff. Now, my good examples are guys like Marichal. Well, I mean, since I was with Arbaugh Club, I would bring up Marichal because Marichal was one of those kind of guys that was a lot of arms and legs and everything else. And to me, this is part of distraction. This is part of deception, these distractive measures. But the guy that's real deliberate just takes the ball and gives you, you know, you take the ball out of your glove, you never lose it. He pitches like a catcher, for example. You don't have any problem with that. But once I hide the ball from the hitter, then I become a lot more effective. And I think the reason I mention this, because I think that I pitched that way, I hid the ball a lot, and I threw the ball more out of my uniform. I would open up, and the ball was hard to follow from in here. So I think if whatever success I might have had for those couple of years, this is what I'd have to attribute it to.
Well, let me see here. Where are we? Oh, how about who are some of the guys that you roomed with?
Roomed with? Oh, mercy. Harry Kraft and I roomed together for every time we were together someplace, we roomed together. We started together in 1935. We were together again in 1937. We were together, we got together again back in 39 with the Big League Club. And so we were together most of the time. I'd say Harry and I roomed together more than anything. Room with a lot of different people, but whenever we were together on the same club, we roomed together.
Are there any good roommate stories? Ever room with somebody's suitcase or they used to say about Ruth?
No.
You spent most of your time either pitching in Crosley or in Polo Grounds.
Yes, in a big league, yes. That's one of two clubs.
Well, which one of the two did you like better? What was your favorite place to pitch in?
Well, Cubs Park was tough. Polo Grounds tough because right down each line of the Polo Grounds, it was really short. And then you had the scoreboards that overhung the field that were in fair territory. And then many times I've seen the outfielders, left fielder, right fielder, be standing there waiting to catch the ball. And these, as I say, the scoreboards were cantilevered out, 10, 15 feet. And the ball would come down, just nicked that scoreboard and would have been caught 230 or 40 feet is all it was. It was only 247 right down the line, both ways. That was tough in there. So what you had to do there, you try to stay away from the guys inside and try to hit. We played everybody in the slots, right center, left center, and try to pitch them that way. Of course, you're going to make a lot of mistakes. You can't, balls are going to get away from you. But that was a tough park to pitch in. Cincinnati wasn't an easy park. It wasn't a very big park. St. Louis was a nice park to pitch in. Old Farmers Field was before they put in the Kiner Gardens and moved in about 30 feet in left field. So Philadelphia wasn't too bad. The old Scheib Park, the ball, you had to hit a ball there pretty good, hit it in there. Gulf Park was atrocious because whenever we'd go into Chicago, we stayed at the Edgewater Beach most of the time. And the first thing you did in the morning when you get up, if you were pitching, was go see which way the wind was blowing. You know, that was tough in that park, really tough. Well, I don't think in those days, though, the balls weren't as lively as they are now either, but they still went out pretty good. I heard Early Wynn make a remark one time. So he's talking about the rabid baseballs. I'm sure you heard this. It's an old story. He said if you cut one open, you'd find a four-barrel carburetor in every one of them. Which is about true. Yeah.
How about some umpires? Was there somebody when you were pitching, saw a certain guy behind the plate that you said that you liked or you didn't?
No, it didn't make a lot of difference. I'll tell you what, we had the greatest rapport with umpires in those days that you can imagine. We buddied with them, we kidded with them, we oftentimes would be together with them at night even. But when the game started, friendship ceased. There was none of this, you know, nothing going on. But we were good friends with those people. Most of our umpires were great. They were good umpires. Good umpires. You know, I was telling this story here a while back. Catfish Clem was one of our old timers. And an old guy by the name of Clark. They were 80 years old. They were still umpiring. And Clem was 81 with the year they finally run him off. 81 years old.
That's amazing.
Well, they were getting too old to be really trying to get out of the way of balls in the infield and stuff, but they were still umpiring. But they were good umpires. And we had a lot of fun with them. We had a lot of fun and they had a lot of respect for each other. I don't think we went at it like we do now, but as I say, even though we were friendly with these people off the field, once this game started, it was a game of baseball then. There wasn't any fooling around. Not at all.
Did you ever get thrown out of a game?
No, sir.
No?
I never did. I've gotten carried off a couple times, but I never got thrown out. We had a fight in Brooklyn, and they seemed to think maybe that might have been one of the things that might have caused me some trouble. I don't want to have a picture anything about it or not, but we had a big fight in the Brooklyn Park. I was pitching a game against Whitlow Wyatt, and there was some ill blood between our club. Whenever we played Brooklyn, if we played him in our park or played him in their park, we're going to fight. Just as sure as the man announces play ball, we're going to have a fight before the game's over, and we had a lot of them. There was a little thing, something brewing from the year before. Wyatt had a run-in with Fry on a play, a tag covering first base, and Whitlow tripped over him and hurt his leg, and he was out quite a while, and he held Fry responsible for this. And that day I'm pitching against him, they were ahead of us 2-1, I think the game was, and we had a down first and third, and there was a ground ball hit to Reese, I believe, or Leo, Pee-wee was playing short. Fry was on first base, and he goes into second base and takes Koskerot was playing second. Reese reached to Koskerot on the fourth play, and Fry took Koskerot out of the play, and the throw went wild in first, up over the first baseman's head, and we scored a tying run. Well, then this happened so fast, Whitlow run off the mound, and he's beating the hell out of Fry. Here's Fry out there, about 155, 60 pounds. And I got almost to him, and someone jumped on my back. I found out years later it was Joe Medwick, but he run his spikes down the back of my leg and scraped a tendon in the back of my heel. And we really had it. Well, we'd have a fight every time we played a gun fight, but he's going to start knocking down. But you see, in those years, the umpire just looked away. He looked the other direction. If you start throwing somebody, they didn't care. That wasn't in under their control. You want to knock somebody down? Knock them down. And we did. And we got knocked down. But you know the funny part about all this? We didn't wear helmets. And you know there's only one case of anybody ever getting hit in the head and fatal. Only one. We didn't wear a helmet in those days, and we got knocked down a lot more than we do now. But you expect it. And you regrouped. you went back after them. That's the way it was. You expected to get knocked down, and they did too. Evened it up, and that was it. Talking about knocking down and getting knocked down, we're playing a game one day. I was with the Giants, and Mel Ott was managing our ball club, and Harry Burkeen is pitching for the Cardinals, and Mize was on our club at the time. Now, not too many people threw it, John, occasionally, but Burkeen hit Mize this day. As soon as he hit him, the Lord strikes me dead in this chair, Ottie got up. I was in the bullpen. He got up and waved to the bullpen, and he waved for a left-hander to start throwing right then, just as soon as he hit him. And we know what's happening. We know what's going on. We had a kid with us. I can't think of his name before we finish the story. A left-hander. I mean, really wild. He's the one he wanted, but he could throw hard as anybody. And we're down there making bets that if he puts him in the game, he can't hit him because he's too damn wild to hit Burkeen. So anyway, he gets Monty Kennedy. And he could throw hard, but he was wild. He gets ready, he gets himself warmed up. And the next inning, now they get us out. Next inning, they come to bat, and as soon as Burkeen came to the plate, the minute he came to the plate, time. And it didn't make any difference who was pitching for us, and whoever it was come out. I'll just show you how emphatic they make this. He goes out and gets his pitcher, and Burkeen's a left-hander, and he waves for Kennedy. And we're not, we're still betting he can't hit him. Well, the first pitch he threw to Burkeen, he hit him right on the side of the knee, the first pitch, and it just hit and just bored in, and looked like it just hit and fell right straight down, and he went down. They got the stretchers and drug him off. Now, Ottie's got another guy ready. He goes out the mound and takes Kennedy out, brings his other pitcher in, and we go on to play. Nothing was said.
And that was the way baseball's played then.
He hit Mize, and Mize was carried off. They hit Burkeen, they carried him off, and we go, the game continues. Nothing was said. They expected it. But that's just how plain it was in those days. And it worked out pretty good. But the big thing they did those days, like just like this situation, they could go after the guy that threw the ball, you see. And now you play the designated hitter, you never get a shot at him. Of course, in the National League, he's still playing, except for the time he's going to get him out there probably before you get a chance to hit him. But then you were out there for the day, so you're going to get a chance to throw at him. And we did.
How about traveling? I imagine all your traveling was by train.
Yes, sir. And it just tears me up to think about these guys with that jet lag, and hear all about a jet lag. And I've often wondered how they would feel about jet lag if they played a doubleheader in Boston, and had to play the next game in St. Louis, and ride that train. They'd have a lot more jet lag than they got right now, by far. Believe me. That's jet lag.
What did you think about traveling? Was it easy for you, or?
Hey, we didn't mind it. We had a lot of fun. We played cards forever, you know. Seemed like it took forever to get there. No, we didn't bother. These things didn't bother us then. Well, as a matter of fact, I think those are some of the best times we had. And it kept everybody together, just like in spring training, which you don't have anymore. We would barnstorm Now nobody barnstorms. Now they don't play. They get on the plane and go home. And just like our club, we're going to go home. We'll play Oakland home and home and home or whatever. In those days, we'd leave Florida and we'd barnstorm with Boston all the time. And we'd start out, we'd be about 2 weeks. We'd play every little town on the way back. We'd be in Durham and we'd be here and we'd be there. And then we'd finally wind up in our town. They'd go on to Boston. We'd open the season. But, you know, about 14 days. And we had a lot of fun. We had three Pullmans, and the Boston Red Sox had three Pullmans. We each had a diner. They hooked the diners up back to back and the three Pullmans away from there. When at night we'd get together with these guys, we were together all the time. We'd intermingle and they'd get the diners together and have a lot of fun and play cards. And, that's when I found, you know, what a real character that Williams was. He was something else for just a young kid, you know. Great, great player, but he was really fun. He was just a big kid. He had more fun playing his game than anybody ever saw. And a hell of a player, a hell of a hitter. But this was the differences. And you talk about differences. A guy from San Francisco asked me a story here a year ago. We were down at spring training. He said, "What do you find difference in spring training?" And I said, "Good Lord." I said, our manager, we didn't have all this help they got. They got 15 or 20 guys around there helping them, for one thing. They've got hitting tunnels all over the dadgum country. They got two or three or four or five parks they can use if they want to. I said, how would you like to train a ball club with 40 or 50 players in one little park, not a hitting tunnel? Nothing. That's all you had. And that's the way they worked. Now you got half of them in a weight room. You got half of them going here and have a... You wouldn't have ever seen this ballpark here on Mojave Street in Phoenix here, but it was a good sized Stetson hat box, really. And that's where we trained the Giants in the 40s. Yeah. Everybody got in shape, just as good as they do now. But the facilities are just so much different. I'm not complaining because they had them and we didn't, but I'm just saying that we got in condition under a heck of a lot more difficult circumstances than they do today, a whole lot more. There's a lot of changes, you know, that you see. And I certainly don't begrudge these guys the conditions they have because they're pretty damn nice. The clubhouses are like Waldorf Astoria. But where the heck is it? I got to show you a picture here. That's a Brooklyn clubhouse. Got one here someplace. That was it. It's got water pipes and everything else hanging all over the walls. And there it is right here. Look at this. Got a great little clubhouse. There's Walters, Jim Turner, Derringer, Joe Beggs, myself, Red Barber, and Lombardi. That's what it looked like. Filthy damn places.
Spacious, too.
Great. One of them sitting on the very close basket there.
Close hamper. Well, talk about the clubhouses. When you played, they played a lot of Sunday doubleheaders, and then they had Monday off.
Quite often.
And then what kind of, you get done playing the first game of the doubleheader, and you go into the clubhouse, what are you looking at? What big spread have they put out for you guys to...
Absolutely nil. Never saw a spread. They wouldn't allow them in the clubhouse. They wouldn't. A lot of those managers wouldn't let you have a sandwich or anything between games. Hell no. I have a soda or something if you find one.
And if you did have something, then you had to pay for it, I take it.
Oh, sure. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
As far as equipment goes, what did the club supply, and what did you have to supply for yourself?
Well, we had to supply sweatshirts, shoes, or strap. They just supplied uniform, cap, socks. That's it. I can even show you an article I just ran through. As I tell you, I was going through my scrapbook, and my 1 year I was invited to camp, Cincinnati, and Gabe Paul, who was our traveling secretary at that time, sent me a check to come to Florida on, by train, Pullman, meals and everything else. $48. That's what I got in advance so I could get me to Florida. Mm-hmm. And the one time before that, I got a notice from the owner of one of the ball clubs, because in those years they were all outright ownerships, you know, and you had working agreements. And they invited me to spring training, and down at the bottom, bring your own uniform. Yeah, great. We never thought anything about it. We thought, well, hey, that's just the way it is, you know. I got to bring some guy with something to work out in. So we'd have something we could put on. It was unreal.
What was it like pitching in Cincinnati in the middle of the summer, or St. Louis in the middle of the summer, on a Sunday afternoon?
Pretty hot.
With them uniforms.
The picture right directly behind you is Vandermeer working me over there. We weighed in and weighed out all the time. That picture was taken. I pitched a shutout against somebody. I think it was this shutout right here against the Dodger ball club. And I lost 16 pounds in 91 minutes in that picture. Of course, it's all, you know, fluid. You're going to have a couple of beers and you got most of it back. But well, 16 pounds in 91 minutes. That's what it was like in Cincinnati. We always said that Cincinnati was where they made the hot weather and shipped it out. They're in St. Louis. And don't think it wasn't hot in St. Louis. It was hot every place. Yeah. Pittsburgh was hot. Humidity was terrible. New York is hot. Humidity there was real high. Chicago wasn't that bad, because they always had pretty good wind off the Great Lakes up there, you know. Chicago wasn't that bad. But St. Louis and Cincinnati, hot, hot, hot.
So you only had two managers in the big leagues. One was McKechnie and the other one was Melvin.
Wow.
And I know what you already told me what you think of McKechnie.
None better than McKechnie. I don't think I should even make any comment about Mel. I will say this, Mel Ott was one of the greatest players I ever saw, one of the greatest. I don't think that he was that great a manager. But you know, it's a funny thing. When you look back at this now, and you tell me if this is right or wrong, but we have searched and searched and searched to find a guy that was a great player and a great manager. We haven't come up with any. Not very many, if any. Now, I think the reason for this being that when a guy's sitting there and he's kind of underprivileged in as much as his ability is short and he's got to really scramble for everything in the world, I think he has to sit there and try to figure out every way in the game to stay in the game when he gets there. His raw ability and everything is not going to keep him there. He's got to do something different. And what I'm trying to say here, I think, is he's got to learn the game and take advantage of every situation. And I think that's what happens to a lot of these guys who become good managers later on. Bill McKechnie was not a great player. In fact, not even a decent player, I don't think, from what they tell me. But to manage a ball club, I mean, a motivator, a father, a priest, a preacher, he did it all. And I might tell you something else. The thing that bothers me a whole lot today is that, to me, to be a good manager, I think his number one requisite is that he should be his own coach at third base. And let him take the abuse for the plays that's made there instead of somebody else. And I think this is one of the number one requisites of a great manager. In those years, you never saw anybody but the manager at third base, and he took his own reps. But now they say the game's so complicated. Now they need four or five or six guys around them, and they don't have enough time to do that. Well, that's a lot of bullshit. That ain't so.
How'd you get along with the press wherever you played?
Great. Good? We had. Well, I don't think enough to be said about the people we worked with at Cincinnati, especially. That's one of the ones we have to do a lot with. It was great. But we were with them just like we were with the players. Them and their wives were with our wives. We were just like one whole big family. Great people. Swope. I named four or five of them that was there in those years. Some old timers. They were old time writers, and now we get a lot of youngsters writing. Just, you know, the new generation of what do you call them, what students they are, journalism students come out and start writing again. I hesitate to think I might say no about it sometimes because, but those old guys, they'd been in it for many, many years, you know, made a career of it. They were great. I think the thing that we noticed more then than now, they just reported what happened on the field. They weren't searching for stuff. And we at no time did we ever have to say, hey, this is off the record now. But they knew it was off the record. And that's the type of people we're dealing with. And you have the greatest confidence in the world in those people. They would write, they would They would let you know at times if they thought you were letting down or something. I don't mean that. But they didn't second guess and do all this stuff that we hear a lot about now. And unfortunately, I think we have so many writers now that are not very familiar with the game itself, that want to write about the game that they don't know anything about. Well, this may be putting it kind of harsh, maybe, but...
No, I think I agree with you.
I think that's a little bit the way it is.
How'd you get along with the folks that ran the team, general managers and the owners? Did you ever have any real problems with them?
Well,
other than...
outside of Mr. Giles, we all had trouble with just Mr. Giles. He come from a whole line of hard general managers, because he was a graduate of the old St. Louis gang, Mr. Ricky and that group, see? Because before he came to Cincinnati, Warren Giles was general manager at their AAA ball club at Rochester, and Gabe Paul, who is still living, lives now in Florida, he was the secretary to Warren Giles, and they came together. And I got to say this about Gabe Paul. The greatest friend I have in the game, one of the greatest, traveling secretaries I ever saw. He was the one that invented, if I can use the word invented, that probably doesn't exactly say it, but he's the guy that came up with this deal where we'd leave home before we ever went spring training. He'd have an itinerary, I'm not trying to say, for everything you did from the day you left your house, when you boarded a train or whatever, until you got to Cincinnati. It was all on paper, just like you're reading right there. If you paid for a cab, or the cabs were paid for, if you got the train, if you got the plane, not plane, but what hotel you were going to go to, if you had a hotel. It was unreal. He's the greatest I ever saw, and he was a hard worker. Gabe Paul, great, great asset to baseball. Wonderful. Most of those people were all right. After I went to New York, I mean, Lord, you and Mr. Stoneham, we got so close to him, and of course my wife has been very close to him and his wife. They both are gone now. She just died about 2 weeks ago, and we became such great friends, more especially after I went scouting. He was probably the most congenial owner I ever saw, and would know your children's first name. He knew everybody he had, and he was had the most compassion of anybody I ever saw. Horace C. Stoneham. Great man. Too bad. This is a problem I think maybe we have in baseball today a little bit. We don't have any baseball people. When I'm saying people now, I'm talking about that made their livelihood that way, like we used to have. That was in baseball for that long. Now his father, Horace's father, had the ball club many, many years back in the 20s. But now we have the shipbuilders, and we have the real estate people, we have the
ball developers, that's what we have in Cleveland.
But we have nobody that owns the club, I think, that really understands the game very well in that respect. And like some of these owners are talking about. Great.
When you first signed, I should ask you this at that time, but what did you get for signing? What was your big bonus?
$75 a month. You know, in those years, this was they were giving me a lot of money. I figured like I told you before, October 1st, 1934, $75. I thought the only way you could get $75 was to rob a bank, and that was just about as close as you come to getting $75 too. Charlie Dressen, he was managing Cincinnati at the time. He lived in my hometown in Decatur, or in Grill there. And he come down to the firehouse just to talk to me, and he wanted to know if I would sign. I said, yeah. I was a junior in high school, 17 years old. Signed a contract, and he said, he's going to give you $75 a month. Well, I happen to know a lot of kids that I played around the park with in our city parks that had been out and playing some pro ball, D leagues. Most of our kids, I only lived 125 miles from St. Louis in Illinois. And most of our kids around here, they'd sign with the Cardinals, so they signed everybody in the country. And I found out that most of those kids started at $35 a month in those years. And if you had a hell of a year, you might have got $50 the next year. But I just started, and Charlie started me at $75 a month. So that was what I started out at.
What was the most money you ever made in 1 year?
I think about 13.5. But my first year in the big leagues, and I've told this story a few times too, I was making $350 a month when I first started pitching regular. And I didn't get, I was raised to $500 a month on June 1st or June 15th, whatever the cutdown date was. They raised me to $500 a month. That's what I meant. And pitching regular.
That's amazing. Did you have to do any, work in the off season to?
Hell, I had to work. I starved to death. Sure.
My wife,
we were married January 1st, 1939. This morning went spring training. And no, she was working, and as soon as the season was over, not very many of those guys were making enough money that they didn't have to work in those days. If you could make $10,000, you were a Houdini then, and then the 30s. It was tough. We didn't make much money.
What kind of work were you doing?
Yeah, I'd do anything. Hell, I did labor of all kinds. Driving a truck or working in mills and worked in the sheriff's department. I did everything, and everything you name it, I did it. And as I say again, I had to. We didn't have any money. Nobody did. In those years. Tough times.
Were you superstitious, or superstitious is what I'm trying
not
to
really.
Say?
Not really.
Not at all?
No.
Did you know anybody that was pretty superstitious? Or?
Oh, you know, I think they overdid that thing. A lot of guys, the most you'd ever hear about would be guys wouldn't step on a chalk lines, and they wouldn't do this, and they wouldn't do that. They'd wear the same thing. I've heard all the stories, but I don't think there was that much to it. It was more or less pumped up, I think. I never saw anybody that I thought won and lost a game over a superstition thought or whatever. I don't believe it.
Well, this was I don't know how much of an adjustment this was, but the question is, was the adjustment from playing baseball to life after baseball easy for you? When you seemed to me like, well, you've been in baseball, you've never really left.
There wasn't any real, I never really got away from it.
Yeah.
You know, then this was the nice part. And I might add this while we're talking about, we people, Rick, in this game, and I'm sure in your livelihood or whatever, some of the places you've been and what you've done, we seem to speak a little different language. In a sense, you know, a lot of people don't really talk baseball language like we do. I mean, there were so many expressions that was used, and you could tell right away when you got out of that kind of a crowd. So, no, I don't think there was any adjustment at all because he stayed right with it. I mean, I was on the field a lot, did a lot of instructing, managing. I'd help with the big league club in the spring, and then I'd leave there and come to our own spring training camp, and we'd help. I helped do a lot of instructing, so we had a uniform all the time. I did for up until about, I guess I was 50 years old or more, when I finally stopped wearing a uniform. Throwing batting practice and helping kids. No adjustment at all, I didn't find. I think my big adjustment's going to come after I get away from this, because I'm going to be away from my kind of people, more or less, you know. That's what worries me a little more now about quitting, even though I had the 60 years in. I think it's time to quit, but I'm afraid to quit. Just about half.
So you've been scouting for the last 40 years.
43 years.
That's what you've been doing. Throw some names at me, the folks that you've signed that we know of.
Well, let me say one thing first. I don't want to get this misconstrued. Much of our work in scouting is combined efforts. So I'm going to lead on from that.
Okay.
We used to have a lot of tryouts in our spring trainings back in the 50s. And we used to get a lot of players in from the Latin countries. We wouldn't allow those people over to sign anybody at all. They would let them recommend them come in, and we'd bring them in, scads of them. And then there was three of us people, Johnny Hudson and I, a little second baseman, used to be with the Dodgers. Hugh Poland, a catcher that used to be with several different big league clubs, including Cincinnati, and myself, and the three of us, we'd have charge of these free agents. And we would select the ones we wanted to sign.
Oh, I see.
As a result of this, we feel like that we had a certain amount of input towards signing these people. One of the first years I recall of signing anybody out there, my first year down there, this would have been along about 55, I think. That first group we get into, we got a good out. We signed Zepeda, we signed Pagan, we signed Julio Navarro, We signed 6 kids in one group out of this whole bunch, and the rest of them we sent back. I was instrumental, very, very much instrumental in the same manner in signing McKelvey. I signed, Tommy Howler, Ron Herbel. I've got about 5 or 6 kids out here now. Patterson, I've got Patterson. I got Benjamin, a new kid that just came up. I signed him out of ASU about 2 years ago. My name is Eamon. They're real high on him. They think he's going to be a pretty good player. So I think I signed, somebody asked me the other day about it, and I was counting them out. I think I signed something like 31 major league players. Mm-hmm. They're going on about as far as names concerned.
Okay, well, 31's pretty good. Tell you what, Gene, let me go with, let me ask you this. When you played with Cincinnati, you were number 39, and when you were with the Giants, you were number 42 and number 35. Is there any significance to those numbers?
No.
That they just threw the uniform at you?
What they gave me, that's what I wore.
Okay.
That's what
it was. Last two. Do you have a favorite memory? You look back now, you've been in baseball almost 60 years. Is there one memory, is there one thing that sticks out above
sure
all
do.
Others?
Sure does. And I talked to my wife about this the other night, because a lot of these things have been coming through my mind now. After I'd had a pretty good year at Peoria, I had a good year at Paducah. Then the next year, I went to Peoria. Now, Paducah was a D league. Peoria was in the old 3A league. It was a B league. I went over to Peoria, and I had a pretty good year there for Ben Tinkup, Phil Indian. Well, something went awry. I don't know what it was, but there's something to do with the rules and the way they had handled my contract. They had to hurry me out of there for some reason or other. They sent me to Waterloo. And I got to Waterloo, and I got in one game relieving, and the next thing I know, the general manager says, hey, we're going to send you to Syracuse, which was idiotic. I mean, it wasn't no sense to send me out of that fast, but there was something going on. I don't know what it was. So I get to Syracuse, and I didn't get to many games up there, and what games I was in, I was wilder than hell. So I can understand why they were a little bit concerned about keeping me there. But I'd had a couple pretty good years, as I say, ahead of this. They didn't take much into consideration of that. So I finished the season out at Syracuse that year. Then I went back to spring training with Syracuse. And I was in pretty good shape because a good friend of mine was managing our ball club, and he liked me, and he was going to let me pitch Jim Bottomley. Do you remember this
one? Yeah.
First baseman, one of the great
Sunny
first
Jim.
Basemen.
Yeah.
Of the game. The old St. Louis ball club. And about all June, first part of June, they fired Jim. Well, the guy also, you remember, you're from Cleveland, took his job. Wiggly Dick Porter. Porter didn't, I wasn't one of Porter's people. There was a lot of the old members there. So I ain't going to get pissed off. So next thing I know, I'm staying at the YMCA hotel, and you asked me to do it. Is there anything ever coming to mind? Yes, this. I went back to the YMCA hotel, and the roof wasn't as big as this. Put it in the bed, maybe in the sink. Bathroom was in a hall someplace. And I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, well, what in the hell am I doing here? You know, what's happening here? I'm trying to get myself, and I'm still a pretty young guy. And I've been booted around pretty good. Now, I got one thing tells me to get the bus and head for Decatur. And the other one says to go on down and go to Columbia, South Carolina. And I'll have a little bit of trouble making up my mind, to be real frank with you. I finally decided to have to. I'm going to go down and I'm going to get one more shot. Well, I went down there. Now, what would have made any difference in my control down there, I'll never know. But I have records of this. I pitched 150 innings consecutively before I was ever relieved down in the Sally League. With the big leagues next year. So that's how close I came to coming this way instead of going that way. So, you know, it's kind of, that was brought back to my memory very, very many times, and especially just a couple days ago. Thought about it again. I can't see myself yet sitting there with my head in my hands. What in the hell am I going to do? You know, I wouldn't make any money. Hell, although they're only making about $200, $250 a month, something like that. So it wasn't any money to that one hit.
Last question. This is the exact opposite of that one. Is there one thing that you'd like to go back and change?
I wouldn't change anything. I wouldn't change the bus rides that I took, the cheese and crackers that I ate. We used to travel on those buses with not the nice seats in them that you sit this way, the ones that sit alongside the windows, you know, that's the way we rode some of them. When I was in the Sally Lake down there, we used to ride those buses, and it would be so hot, we'd ride up in the baggage rack up on top at night traveling. And I'd miss all this. I wouldn't want to do it over without doing all those again, because I think it makes you appreciate a whole lot of things. And I got to repeat the thing that I told you earlier today, that I am so appreciative for numerous things. Number one, that I had the opportunity that I spoke to you about due to the illnesses, because I may not have ever pitched an inning in the big league. And I know this. This could have happened to a lot of people. I was so thankful for the opportunity. The other thing is that just the journeyman kind of a guy that I was, I had the opportunity, as I mentioned to you, to play with and against some of the greats. I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. No way. Now I've been into scouting, and you see some of my stuff up there that I've acquired. And hey, what in the world could anybody ask for? Played in the big leagues, and pitched in two World Series. Been picked the Scout of the Year. I've been, I don't know what else I've done. Dig ditches, I guess, probably. Probably went back home to Decatur from that YMCA. That's probably what I'm doing today. Had a good chance of it, anyway.
Okay, Gene. Thanks for spending time with me.
You're so welcome. You're so welcome.